Welcome to the OMFIT podcast.
Good afternoon and welcome to the OMFIF podcast. My name is Taylor Pierce. I'm an economist here at OMFIF's Economic and Monetary Policy Institute. It's a pleasure for me to welcome Gloria Bartoli today to our podcast to discuss the many facets of debt sustainability. Gloria is a senior fellow at the Economic Foundation of Tor Vergata University in Rome, where she manages the Observatory on Productivity and Well-being. She's also professor of public management within the social sciences faculty at Louis and Rome, and a former lecturer at the Italian School of National Administration. Gloria boasts years of experience in international organizations, including the OECD, IMF, UNCTAD, the World Bank, and the WTO, and has spent many years working with Italian institutions in both the public and private sectors. She has contributed to the design of international policy and regulatory frameworks, including the reform of international institutions at the G7, fiscal policies at the IMF, foreign trade at the World Bank and WTO, and business climate and foreign direct investment at UNCTAD and the World Bank. From 2011 to 2016, Gloria was a member of the Council of Experts at the Ministry of Economy and Finance of Italy, where she advised the Director General of the Treasury on macroeconomic and structural issues. In this capacity, she also represented the Italian Treasury at the Economic Policy Committee of the OECD during a very challenging time for Italy and Europe, contributing to the preparatory discussions with the IMF and the European Commission. It's a pleasure to have you here today, Gloria. Obviously, we've seen public debt ballooning as a result of emergency pandemic relief measures. Could you start by giving us an overview of the current debt landscape in Europe?
Yes, and thank you, Taylor. Thanks to the OMFIF for the invitation. The pandemic has forced the governments to raise debt in every country to face health and economic challenges. At the world level in 2020, debt has reached a record 100% of GDP. Advanced economies debt was at 123%, of which the US at 134%. Japan, the highest as usual, 257, and the EU, 99, that is 100%. The 16.9 trillion measures implemented globally to fight the pandemic ended in 2021, and a partial recovery took place. Thus, a slight decrease of deficit and debt, at just 1.1 percentage point, was recorded in 2021. Some countries overachieved. Italy, for instance, has already reduced in 2021 by 5 percentage points its public debt ratio, instead of the 2 percentage points forecast, to 150% of GDP. It confirms that the more effective way to reduce debt is growth. In 2021, Italy was more than 6%, memories of the economic miracles of the 60s, plus the reduction of some support measures from the pandemics. Following the Russian invasion of Ukraine and the sanctions imposed to Russia, all forecasts for growth, inflation, etc. should be reviewed. In a recent estimate for Italy, if the prices for energy, raw materials, and food, Ukraine, you know, is the third producer of wheat in the world, remain as the beginning of the invasion, imports will increase by 3.5% of GDP. The state subsidy to limit energy price will be around 1% of GDP in Italy, like in France. The effects on public accounts will be a reduction of the debt ratio to GDP by 2.8%. This is because revenues from VAT, which includes imported inflation, will increase more than the GDP deflator, even taking into account an increase of interest rates. For the euro area, the ECB estimates that with the present supply and prices of gas, production will decrease by 0.2% by year end. If a 10% rationing of gas will be necessary, the loss will be 0.7% of European Union value added.
I see. So I wonder if you can tell us, as we are hopefully moving into the post-pandemic era and as this exceptional fiscal impulse wanes around the world, what broader fiscal developments can we anticipate in the near future?
The fiscal, after the invasion of Ukraine, the fiscal impulse is not expected to wane in Europe. The income fiscal support to offset the lockdowns ended, but there will be support for firms hit by the sanctions, plus expenditures for defense and refugee crisis, and there will be huge investment, I hope, to support whatever will keep us independent from Russian energy imports. This should add up to the New Generation EU initiative. A balance should be struck between a medium-term strategy to reduce the debt and the need for fiscal support of the economy. This in Europe has coincided with the discussion about reinstalling in 2023 the fiscal rules suspended during the pandemic or reform them.
Yeah, that's a great segue into my next question. So as you alluded to, the EU's fiscal framework is up for debate next year, with the role of the Stability and Growth Pact due to either be reinstated or updated, as you mentioned. The EU fiscal rules are infamously complex. Can you provide us with an overview of the key fiscal rules, six packs, two packs, the fiscal compact, etc.?
Yes, but let me make a short premise. In the present situation in Europe, I think we should stop bickering about fiscal rules until the end of the New Generation EU program in 2026. And create, as I already mentioned, an even bigger program for energy autonomy in Europe, as green as possible. But let's illustrate the rules, the reasons to change them, and the best proposals for the change. The original 1992 rules of stability of the Stability Growth Pact, that is the debt to GDP ratio of 60% and the deficit to GDP ratio of 3%, were meant to limit excessive deficits and debts in order to protect the euro area from default in a member country sovereign debt that would affect the banks, in turn producing negative externalities to the whole financial sector. The nickname for this sequence is the diabolic loop. 60% to GDP was the average debt of the area at that time. Italy had a debt around 100%. However, Italy never defaulted, while Greece, Ireland, Portugal, Cyprus needed an adjustment program with the Troika as a consequence of the global financial crisis. All these countries, apart from Greece, were compliant with the fiscal rules. Ireland was a first of the class, with 25% debt to GDP ratio, just before the contingent liabilities of commercial banks materialized. So the rules didn't work. In 16 years, the rules didn't protect the country's financial stability and increased debt. Instead of asking why the rules proved useless, more rules were added, starting in 2011. The six-pack, two-pack, and the so-called fiscal compact that includes most of the previous. They were much more detailed in order to cyclically adjust the budget balance and provide a medium-term objective to ensure that the 60% debt objective will be achieved. The vademecum to calculate the new objectives counts 270 pages. They resulted more restrictive and obscure. in short, otherwise I need the equivalent of 270 pages, to get the structural balance, potential output and output gap had to be calculated. But after a deep crisis like the global financial crisis, the calculation of these unobservable variables was cured, and the results went against the reality of high unemployment and lagging growth. The OECD ended up applying a smell test to correct unrealistic results of its output gap calculation. The obscurity and the procyclicality made the rules impossible to implement without recurring to flexibility. As an example, the fiscal compact specified that debt exceeding the limit should be reduced every year by 1/20th, 5%, until reaching the 60%. This implies positive fiscal balances, that is, surpluses, for decades, and in a period of a high unemployment and stagnant growth. Then, it will be not a surprise that the only result of this new fiscal governance was delaying the recovery in the area, which wasn't back yet to the pre-crisis output when the pandemic burst. Instead, the US, the epicenter of the crisis, kept growing from 2010 onwards. With the new rules, even when the Commission judged appropriate an expansive fiscal stance of the area, adding up the national stability plans produced the contractionary stance for the area. But it was a lesson not forgotten for the next and much worse pandemic crisis. This time, the Stability and Growth Pact was suspended with a general escape clause, a move that gives an idea of its help to stability. Fiscal policies could do their part at the national level, and the Commission launched the Next Generation EU initiative for 750 billion euros. The ECB started the 185 trillion pandemic emergency purchase program to buy sovereign corporate bonds, adding up to the asset purchase program. These have kept liquidity flow into all euro area countries, preventing the fragmentation of the market and allowing the smooth transmission of monetary policy. So this time the banks were an element of support of the economy.
Thank you for that very comprehensive overview. It's, as you mentioned, the fiscal framework is very complex, and I personally would argue, and many have, that it's proven insufficiently flexible and no longer fit for purpose. Is it fair to say you agree with that sentiment, that there needs to be a higher degree of flexibility in the EU fiscal framework? And what are some of the key issues you see that are coming up for debate?
First of all, I think the issue of flexibility, which, as I explained before, was widely applied, is taken out now from people who want to reestablish the rules as they were. The general escape clause of the SGP ends with 2022. That is 3 years before the end of the New Generation EU in 2026. Some countries, maybe the one talking about flexibility, ask to restore them as they were. But it will not be possible for three main reasons. First, many countries will find themselves not in compliance with the rules because the public investment made according to the NGU, the Recovery and Resilience Plans, increase debt every year, while the effect on growth are lagged. It is not very realistic nor desirable to reduce public investments, given the green transition requiring them to crowd in private investments, and given the now urgent European autonomy from Russian energy imports. Second, for their obscurity, which feeds populists, and for their failures to reduce debt. Third, and not least, because they are not fit for the economies of the 2020s. In fact, the fiscal rules must take stock of the two defining characteristics of the financial environment since the global financial crisis. First, the size of public debt, and second, the zero lower bound of the interest rate. The debt accumulated to fight the pandemics has raised the average debt of the euro area to 100%, no more 60% of GDP as in 1992. Therefore, the target of the debt rule must be adjusted, or the pace of reduction has to be slowed. All the reform proposals start from here. Regling, the ESM director, proposed to adopt 100% debt to GDP as the target, but his fellow Germans didn't agree. An alternative proposed by the European Fiscal Board fixed a different debt threshold for each country. Another proposal by the former director of fiscal affairs at the IMF is to exclude COVID debt bought by the ECB from the total debt to be reduced. Since the interest of this debt is returned to government as distribution of profits, it becomes just an accounting item, irrelevant for debt sustainability. This exclusion should be accompanied, of course, by a freeze in the liquidity created by the purchases through an increase in bank reserve requirement. Finally, a proposal supported by Draghi and Macron in a Financial Times article focused on reducing the speed at which each country has to reach the debt limit. A 60% limit with 1/20 reduction per year means, for countries with high legacy debt, like Italy, a primary balance equal to 5% of GDP every year, simply impossible to achieve. This lower speed will be applied to the debt incurred for the sovereign debt crisis and the COVID crisis. And the French-Italian proposal envisages to transfer COVID debt from the balance sheet of the European Central Bank to a European Debt Management Agency, or the ESM, which will pay it with newly issued bonds. This will also help the ECB in two ways, by providing European debt for its purchases, but also by separating monetary policy operation from debt management intervention. The countries will continue to service the debt, but they will profit from the difference in returns between sovereign bonds and EU bonds. New Generation EU has showed the interest of financial markets for European debt in an environment characterized globally by low interest rates and high world demand for safe assets. Despite the fact that most proposals to reform the fiscal rules include a golden rule to allow public investments on European priorities for climate and digitalization, some frugal countries put a veto on it. If this position is not going to change, I see the only solution in a new EU initiative, but even bigger than the Next Generation EU, for financing the European priorities, like a climate fund. Who wants to restore the old rules misses not only the higher size of debts, but also the low interest rates in the last 30 years. Especially after the global financial crisis, interest rates are close to zero lower bound, and this increases debt sustainability. Basic equation for debt sustainability, that is debt equal to the surplus or deficit, the balance, plus rate of interest less growth rate, weighted for growth, multiplied by the debt stock. In the difference, interest rates minus growth rate, if the interest rates is smaller than growth, debt doesn't explode, even with continuous deficit, with some qualifications. Please note, also the primary balance depends on investments, in visible and invisible capital that increase productivity, then growth, which determines the tax base and the capacity of raising taxes by the government to reach the warranted balance. Crisis burst because of unforeseeable events. Next will be due to a psychopathic autocrat or lack of credibility of government. To increase debt sustainability, fiscal policy should allow quality investment that increase productivity, thus long-term growth, lowering the debt. If returns to investment are larger, everybody knows that financing larger than financing cost, debt will go to zero. In other terms, in addition to the public accounting dimension of debt, there is another dimension of public debt, the macroeconomic one. And low interest rates reduce the tools of monetary policy for output stabilization and make fiscal policy central for macroeconomic stability. The super accommodative monetary policy has been successful in keeping at bay recession. However, after more than a decade, had also an unwarranted effect, the slowdown in productivity, despite digital revolution and technological progress. One of the main reasons is that non-viable firms didn't go bankrupt, thanks to the near zero interest rate. And the lack of resource allocation across firms and sectors is a major factor of the slowdown in productivity, which is the engine of long-term growth. To conclude, predetermined rules, however complicated, are a dangerous act of hubris by politicians who presume to be able to predict the future. To smooth crises when they happen, a central fiscal capacity is the rational and tested choice. We have the U.S. history. But the structural central facility of the NGU type is equally important to support public investment, to boost total productivity and growth potential in order to build tax base and service debt in the long run. This is why Blanchard's proposal is to adopt stochastic analysis case by case and qualitative standards to control debt and target long-term growth through increased productivity. 3 and 60 are only numbers, would say James Bond.
Yeah, thank you. I've also read the Blanchard proposal. I think it's a really interesting and creative approach to the fiscal framework, providing for some flexibility and selective public expenditure on productive expenditures. And I appreciate your assessment of the NextGen EU fund and how you see these instruments as potentially a catalyst to broader reforms. If it's all right, I'd like to change gears slightly and move on to monetary policy, which you have also alluded to in referencing the ECB, the PEP program, the APP, and also interest rates. So in her February 3rd speech, Christine Lagarde refrained from explicitly ruling out a rate hike this year. Maybe that will be changing as ongoing developments progress, but the announcement nevertheless spurred a spike in Italian bond yield spreads relative to Germany, and Spanish, Portuguese, and Greek bonds also saw yields rising significantly. So in light of these developments, how do you assess the ECB's willingness and ability to back more heavily government's debt?
The reactions of financial markets after this ECB turn to a less dovish position were quite moderate and showed well-anchored expectations. Take August 2020 as baseline. Germany yields were negative up to almost 30 years. French yields up to 15 years. Spanish negative up to 7 years. For Italy, the country with the highest yields, the 30-year yield was less than 2%. After the sell-off following the last ECB press conference, the 7-year BTP yield for Italy was 1.5%, while in the sovereign debt crisis in 2012, it reached 7%. Today, March 1st, the BTP yield is 1.67, and the spread with the bond decreases. And I would like to specify that the ECB doesn't have a target for government debt, but it should ensure the transmission of monetary policy to the whole area of the euro. If different countries have different interest rates, the market is fragmented and dysfunctional. It is no question of backing highly indebted countries. However, since February, a few central banks in the euro system, which look at the headline inflation rather than underlying inflation or medium-term inflation, were putting at risk the recovery, exactly like in 2011. The wrong policy measures adopted after the global financial crisis created a growth gap not yet recovered with the US, as already mentioned. And the lesson should not be forgotten. The present inflation is not from demand, which is still lower than 2019, but from imported supply shocks, including rationing from Gazprom. The Ukraine invasion has changed the game. On one side, inflation pressure will increase and continue for longer because of the energy and food prices. On the other side, the slowdown in growth because of the war, but also of the sanctions, will require caution on interest rate changes. In the ECB words, it would be unwise to pre-commit on future policy steps.
Definitely. I hear you. I agree with you. Looking to the future, how do you anticipate debt dynamics will be impacted by a number of factors? Perhaps first, it would be timely to discuss not only a more antagonistic Russia, but also an increasingly tense geopolitical landscape, U.S.-China tensions maybe rising, and other various geopolitical tensions.
So for geopolitical tensions, which are not future, are present, they have a negative effect on growth than on the debt ratio. Moreover, more fiscal impulse for defense expenditure and refugees, but inflation will balance in part the effect on debt. While I expect that the long-term expectation for inflation and interest rates will stay anchored.
And this is perhaps a different challenge, but does tie in somewhat with immigration. What do you think that demographic changes and particularly aging societies will have? What impacts will that have on debt dynamics?
This will be negative for the weight of pensions as contingent liabilities, and the assessment in the, this is enter in the assessment of sustainability of debt. I hope that Ukrainians could come back to their country, Putin free. If not, this enormous exodus could help West European prospects.
Oh, I certainly hope that as well, for all the people in Ukraine. Can you also talk about digitalization and what impacts this could have?
Digitalization increases productivity, then growth, then sustainability of debt.
A very succinct answer, short and sweet. And finally, what will the transition to a net zero economy look like for debt dynamics? Obviously, this is going to be a very expensive project for countries around the world.
But it's not all negative. On the contrary, since we have already globalized the most polluting firms, the effect on growth shouldn't be negative. Also because we started this process before others, and our solutions will be adopted, sold. The OECD research finds from trade data that Scandinavian countries, the first to start the process, find the new markets for low emission products and support services. Reallocation of resources will take place without sectors, but also without firms. And when we'll embrace fully the transition, the investment required are forecast at about 300 trillion in 3 decades. This implies the end of secular stagnation, with interest rates increasing, but growth increasing even more, thus more sustainable debt.
I love how optimistic that sounds. Those are all of my questions. So thank you very much for speaking with me today. And I just want to ask if there's any final thoughts you have or final points you'd like to make.
Thank you to you and Ronfif. I don't think I have what to say on this subject.
Thank you so much once again, Gloria, for being with us here today and for a fascinating discussion on debt sustainability. And thank you for listening and tuning in. Make sure you subscribe to the OMFIF podcast. It's available on Spotify, iTunes, and wherever you can find podcasts.
Thank you for listening to the OMFIF podcast.